Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
All right. Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin. My guests today are Dan Liebenson and Lex Rofberg, who are the hosts of the podcast Judaism Unbound. I've asked them onto the program today as kindred souls in doing a podcast about the Jewish community and in the perspective that they've gained over the last 3.5 years, with almost 180 guests sharing their experience doing something Jewish somewhere and coming from two very different backgrounds. So I'm excited to dive in and see what we can glean from their conversations as it pertains to us as professionals in the field. So welcome to the program, Dan and Lex.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks. This is great.
Very nice to speak to fellow podcasters. So hopefully this will be entertaining for everyone. But I'd like to start, as I always do, we heard a little bit about both of your backgrounds in terms of how you got to this particular place in time on this interview with me. But I'd love to hear from you as to how you kind of meandered your way to sitting in this chair right here. And you guys can decide between the two of you who wants to start.
Dan, I'll start. I usually start our podcast. So this is Dan. Actually, I'm not sitting in a chair. I'm standing at a treadmill desk where my podcast studio is set up. Actually, our family was talking about six-word biographies the other day, and the one I came up with was "Too Much School, Now a Podcaster." How we got here, how I got here, is quite a strange story, not an intentional one. I mean, I'll just start, I guess, I'll just start with a big picture, and then we can drill down if you want,
perfect.
Sure that Lex goes. But basically, the way that I tell my life history, which is always a little different from how it actually was, but I grew up as the son of a conservative rabbi in Long Island, New York. And when I was 14, we made Aliyah and moved to Israel, which was not something that I had been aware that the family was discussing. It subsequently, my parents asked me things like, well, why do you think we spoke Hebrew to you in your childhood? And I said, well, I thought you wanted me to know Hebrew. It never occurred to me that we were going to be moving to another country. And then when we got to Israel, which was in the mid-1980s, at least my parents had a sense that it was really a binary situation in Israel. Either you could be religious or secular, and they put us in the religious category. And so I ended up going to high school at an Orthodox high school that, again, was not really sort of what I had been prepared for in my conservative day school childhood. So I often sort of think that although my dad doesn't always like to hear it this way, and if he's listening, I'm sure we'll have a conversation about it. But I say that while I certainly had positive Jewish experiences during that time, I would say overall I experienced Judaism as a force that was kind of preventing me from doing what I really wanted to do. You know, that I had to sit in the front row or the third row in services, which I found boring when my dad was a rabbi, and it meant that I was uprooted from where I knew and brought to another country where I basically spoke the language but didn't really know much about the culture, and it was difficult. And then going to an Orthodox school was very difficult for me and was not something that I sort of believed in and knew how to handle.
And 14-year-olds are a perfect time to make a transition like that, right?
Right. Well, everybody seems to have that reaction except my parents. So that's an interesting, scenario. So I ended up with an extraordinary Jewish education. And so, when I was getting ready to go to college, and we had kind of made a deal that I would go to Israel kind of without fighting too much. But the plan would be that I would come back to America for college. And, when I got into my senior year of high school, if you would have put me in college right then, who knows what would have happened. I could easily imagine that I would have drifted very far away from Jewish life. It turned out that in my senior year, or the end of my junior year, the beginning of my senior year in high school, I don't quite remember, I read the book, which had just come out, called Who Wrote the Bible by Richard Elliot Friedman. And it was a book that kind of gave a popular audience access to academic biblical scholarship and archaeology and biblical criticism. And it kind of retold all the stories that I knew from the Bible in a way that was profoundly different from the way that I had learned it in my childhood. And in my childhood, I learned it in a way that I was actively resisting. And, you know, that I only kind of knew what I was against and what I didn't believe. And reading Who Wrote the Bible gave me a different lens into the same material that was a new lens for me. And it was something exciting, and it felt like something that I could believe in. And it got me really excited about the material of Judaism, which I knew a lot about, and kind of got me thinking in a new way. So
you became a lawyer?
So I went to college, and I became active in Hillel, which I don't think I would have done had I not had that experience. And I ended up becoming the president of Hillel. But I never imagined doing that professionally, because I had such a strong sense that this is like not a particularly happy part of my life. So as a volunteer, I might want to do things differently on campus, but the idea that it would be a profession never occurred to me. It never even crossed my mind. And so, you know, I ended up going to law school and becoming a law professor. And what happened was that I was teaching at a Catholic law school, I ended up, and there were all these interesting fights among the faculty about what it meant to be a Catholic law school and what kind of Catholic law school did we want to be. And it was kind of, you know, felt like these were decisions that were only going to be made over decades. And I was kind of excited about it, and I wanted to participate in them. But at some point it dawned on me that if I'm going to spend the rest of my life fighting to right some dysfunctional religious institution, it might as well be in my own community.
Right. So, that's awesome.
So at that point, I applied for Hillel jobs, because basically that was the only Jewish organization I knew. I mean, that was really the only, you know, I'd been in Israel. The only American Jewish organization that I really knew well at all was Hillel. And so when I thought that I wanted to work in the Jewish community, that was pretty much the only thing that occurred to me, the only thing that I felt qualified for, the only thing that I thought I might be interested in. And that was how I ended up as a Hillel director. And then, you know, we can sort of talk more, I think, after Lex goes, about how the podcast ended up starting. But that was kind of my route into Jewish professional life.
That's awesome. It's crazy how one book can kind of influence you all the way to where you are today. It's awesome.
Absolutely. And by the way, it was a dream come true that we've had Richard Elliot Friedman on our podcast.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, that was an extremely meaningful experience to be able to have him on.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right, Lex, you got a bit of a different story to tell, huh?
Yeah, a bit of a different story, and a bit of like a weirdly similar story in some ways. I'll start with when I learned that Dan was a professor at a Catholic law school. I learned this after I started working with/for Dan. And my dad is a professor at a Jesuit law school at Marquette University. I never thought of that as like a particularly formative part of me, but like, and look, we have a sample size of one, but like the ways in which Dan and I have deeply aligned and been able to connect around a lot of things, I've like been thinking of the fact of my dad's role at Marquette Law School differently, and as like maybe subconsciously, implicitly, like affecting both the law part. Like my mom is also a lawyer, so like I knew that like law argumentation, all of those things were very important to me, and that was actually not so much the Jewish, I mean, I know obviously there's all sorts of Jewish roots of argumentation, et cetera. But like for me, that was just like both my parents were lawyers around the dinner table. We argued about stuff and we liked it. But I've been thinking about whether there were ways in which like having that context of like we were deeply embedded in Jewish life, but in a different way from a lot of people, I think. I went to a school, I went to the same school from when I was four until I graduated high school. It was an independent school. I was one of the only Jews in my grade. And I think in the high school at any given time, there were probably like 20, 25 Jews in the high school. So in my grade, there were whatever, six, seven. And it's interesting because growing up, I never thought of myself as particularly Jewishly involved. And I often analyze why, because by many objective measures, I was. So I went to Jewish summer camp from third grade all the way through being a camp counselor. I joined BBYO in high school. I did a lot of like measurably Jewish and institutional involvements that, like, if you check them on the forms, sort of right. indicate you are like in the
you have
in
been
the
deemed
engaged crowd or whatever.
Yeah, Jewish enough.
But like, I never thought of myself as being that Jewish, because I think we all have, whether we define it or society defines it or Jewish institutions define it, we all have this sense that like being Jewish only correlates with how you observe religious holidays. And my family, look, we went to Shabbat services once every 6 weeks, maybe, more than most of my Jewish friends.
Right, I was going to say, that's not terrible.
Yeah, that was not nothing, but we didn't go tons. And we were I'd say more than high holiday Jews in terms of religious observance, but we were high holidays plus Passover plus Hanukkah is pretty much the rhythm. I think if you were to ask me even at the end of high school, like what's Sukkot, I could have given you like there's the hut thing and, right. and the lulav. Like I don't think I could have given you anything about what that was. I don't think I could have done that for almost any holiday other than those big three.
So was there something else you wanted to be in your life than a Jewish professional?
Yeah. So there, I was very certain I was going to go into math. I was a huge math guy growing up. Mathlete, the whole nine yards. I continue to think of myself as a math person, by the way. I for people who listen to our podcast, I often will like I look at everything through like the lens of numbers and geometry and
right.
all and equations. Like I'm very much like an algebraic thinker in the grand scheme of things. But I thought I was going to be a math major, and I started in college as a math major. And I think if I had started as an applied math major, I might have stuck with it. The math department at my school was not the strongest department at our school, and I only knew that after I started taking the classes. And I think it sort of scared me off. And made me want to look at something else. But I didn't immediately run to Judaic studies. The end result is I did major in Judaic studies. But for a little while, I was just floating in a place of not knowing what my major was. And I was actually fine with that. But I found myself in like my education class or in my anthropology class or whatever, a class that was not about Jewish anything directly. I found myself writing final projects about, how Jewish stuff relates to the content of X, Y, or Z class.
Right.
There I am with math variables, X, Y, and Z.
Yes.
But like, I found myself doing that enough times that I had a moment where I was like, I should just like do the thing. I should just like do Judaic studies instead of playing this game where I map it onto everything else.
Right.
So that's when I shifted. That was along with early in college, me sort of jumping into every last Jewish project that there was. I'm like literally everyone. I became very involved in Hillel. I joined the Jewish fraternity, which at the time was AEPI and is now its own independent Jewish fraternity called Beta Rho Pi. I was learning with the various rabbis that floated around campus, all of them, like three every single week at different points. I was doing all this stuff. And it actually, I bring it up because it traces back to that early story, which is that I arrived on campus feeling deeply un-Jewish and like I didn't know anything. And I felt like my kind of Judaism was like not right. And I felt like I needed to do all of this work and learning in order to be sort of the right kind of Jew. I felt like, sure, I did all the Jewish camp stuff, but like I don't know anything. And I was really, right. I can't overstate how insecure I was about that. And I modeled like every element of my life around trying to become a person that would be seen as like legit in a Jewish space. And I look back on that version.
Is that unfortunate that you have to go to rabbinic school to feel legit in a Jewish space?
But. Well, the rabbinical school piece was like a whole other set of things that would go on for way too long. But like the rabbinical school piece, I didn't decide to be a rabbi until after college.
Right.
I was actively resistant Because friends would say to me, you're going to be a rabbi, and I would like yell at them. Like I would get really upset.
Well, I was trying to counsel you against it.
Yeah. And you still, here I am, you know, a year or two out and from ordination, and you're still, which is, look, I have days like that.
You wanted the knowledge. You wanted to have some of the
background. Yeah, but I did want the knowledge, but I say that with like a big caveat, which is I think I mostly wanted to feel in the club. Like I wanted the knowledge because I felt like without it, I was not seen. And I think to some extent, this was true. Like, I think there were people who saw me as like, okay, he like comes to stuff, but he doesn't really, like, he's not one of the core people that's going to be the leaders here. And I think right. I wanted to prove that wrong. So if I were to go back, I would tell that version of Lex that like, look, don't feel that way. Right. your I call it Machmir cultural Judaism, like your stringently deep cultural Judaism that you had in your family growing up, where there were Barbara Streisand posters on the wall and Marx Brothers references were an everyday thing. And is it good for the Jews? And I've got a Dr. Brown's Celray Soda next to me right now. Like literally every last piece of like stereotypical Jewishness oozed into my life all the time. Right. And I still felt like I was less than. And I think that reflects a number of things. And it's probably why in the realm of Jewish professional things, I'm specifically doing this work where we're trying to upend what it means to be an authentic.
Awesome. Well, master at transitions, Lex. And so here we go into this podcast of what are you guys doing? What is it? How did it start? How has it evolved? Like I said, you guys have had almost 200 episodes, which is awesome. A million listeners plus. That's amazing. How did we get here?
I don't know.
Well,
I blinked and there we are.
I mean, it started basically some years after I was a Hillel director at the University of Chicago for about 6 years. And then we ended up doing another program on campus for about 4 years. And I'd gotten to this point where I wanted to write a book, where I had sort of come to a conclusion that although we were having great success at engaging students in Judaism on campus, that for a variety of reasons, I was feeling like it's not the right work. It's part of it. And it's of course important for people to feel engaged, but engaged in what? And that if we were trying to basically just do a good marketing job and get people to kind of connect to Jewish life, but then they found it ultimately wasn't doing the work in their lives that they needed done, then what was it really all for? And I started to have this feeling that we're actually in this major transition point in Jewish history. And I wrote an article in Zik magazine, you know, Zichrono Livracha. There are a lot of magazines that we've written
Zichrono Livracha
that are not around anymore. Shema just recently, and that might be something to talk about actually. But I wrote this article that it was a Jewish education issue that they had, and I called it Jewish Education for a Time of Wandering. And that was where I started to play with the metaphor that we are a desert generation, that we're actually wandering in the wilderness, that we have left one form of Judaism behind, but we don't yet know what the new form of Judaism is, and that we're in this period of not knowing and wandering, and that's natural, that's as it should be. We've been there many times before, not many, but a few times before. We were there in the wandering in the wilderness in the period after the destruction of the first Northern Kingdom, in the period of the Babylonian exile, in the period of Yavne, where the rabbinic program started. And so here we are again. And I wanted to write a book about that. And when Lex came to work with me, the idea was that we were working together to try to get this book done. And Lex was actually doing a lot of research and reporting what he was finding. And at a certain, and we were trying to talk through the argument of the book. And at a certain point, we felt that we didn't quite have it, that we had a story to tell about the past. And I think we more or less had a story that we wanted to tell about the future, although that has changed over the last 4 years that we've been doing the podcast. But I don't think that we really, I think we were struggling to know what was in the middle, how to really interpret what was going on today in light of that story. And we felt like we needed to do more research. And I think that, Lex, you can sort of weigh in. I think that, at least for me, there were two main drivers to do the research in the form of a podcast. One was that I think I somehow imagined that more important people would be willing to talk to us if we could tell them that we were like getting them publicity, you know, like that we were, you know, right. So it wasn't just these two random guys that they never heard of that are wanting, you know, a couple hours of their time. which probably actually a lot of them would have given. These are extremely generous people, but that we somehow, you know, it would be more attractive if it was a podcast. And I think the other reason was that I had been listening to this very particular podcast, which is called The Critical Path. And it's about applying a specific theory of innovation, disruptive innovation theory, to Apple Computer, which that's my real religion. And I love this podcast so much. And it was just kind of like, it was taking a single theory and really trying to dig deep in how it applies to all kinds of different dimensions. And so there was a way in which Judaism Unbound was meant, at least in my head, to be the critical path for Judaism. And that was the original vision. I mean, our podcast turned out pretty different from The Critical Path in terms of how its format is done. The Critical Path is mostly just one guy talking a lot, and he has kind of a sidekick that asks him questions right. to try to draw out his thinking, whereas ours has become much more about interviews and the two of us talking together. But that was the original vision for me.
So did you bring this vision to Lex, or was there like an aha moment of like, well, we have to start a podcast, or like, hey, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts. What an interesting medium. I mean, you guys really came in. It's where the podcasting world is now, even from when I started, which was a year after you guys, to today, is just ballooned. So very appreciative to everyone for taking the time to listen to us. But you know, how did you get wrapped up into this, and what was that spark that was like, all right, buy the mics, get the program, let's learn about this?
It was probably a text thread. I honestly don't remember. It was probably literally that Dan, we have a lot of, it's probably striking listeners already, like both Dan and I have a lot of like grandiose ideas, like on a relatively regular basis, and some of them are terrible. Some of mine are terrible. All of Dan's are golden, but we like text each other like grand epiphanies sometimes, and I think there was a text thread or something along those lines that was like, yo, we should try a podcast. And my response was, of course, great. I know everything about podcasts. No, that was not, right. No. I had like maybe listened ever to like one episode of one podcast.
Right.
And had never done any kind of audio production at all, other than my once a week high school class for one semester called music technology.
That's awesome.
That was literally my familiarity with audio editing, says the guy who now edits audio most workdays. I don't really know, other than that it sounded fun is part of the answer.
Right?
It seemed like we can't say enough how little it is that we knew who we were at the beginning. Like Dan hired me and said, there's this thing called the Institute for the Next Jewish Future that exists. And I was like, okay, so what is it? And it's like, well, it's whatever we do now.
Want it to be.
Existed in the sense that there had been paperwork filed.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the podcast, on some level, it was concrete and like something that would measurably make some sense of what we do. Because at that point, we were literally, we use the word think tank. We were thinking with each other, and and I think that we tried it out and we had no idea what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And we had no idea if people were going to accept our invites to speak with us. And like, to this day, almost everybody has. We've had very few people say no or not, or even not respond. We've had a couple non-responses, but people are ready to schmooze publicly. It's nice.
Yeah.
I got pulled in, and I was excited by how I'm somebody who, in general in life, I tend to do like unexpected wild things. I like risks. I like taking weird directions that surprise people sometimes. You know, I'm in a rabbinical program through the Jewish Renewal Movement, which is kind of off the beaten path in certain ways. I like spent 2 years living in Mississippi, which certainly surprised a lot of my friends more than those I knew who like went to the Peace Corps in Africa. Because for whatever reason, we like, it shocks people when you live in Mississippi for a couple of years. And this was just like, oh yeah, we're going to start a podcast and nobody's going to see that coming. And that works for me. And then we started it and we found that it was doing something. I don't know that we at the time could quite quantify what it was that we were doing, but it seemed powerful. And we've started maybe now, like a couple years later, to have a sense of like what we're actually doing.
What you're doing.
Well,
yeah,
one thing I would say, like, when we started was that I think we had read all kinds of like random things on the internet, none of which we really verified, but it was things like, when you're starting a new podcast, you should release the first 3 episodes immediately, you know, on the first day.
Right. I didn't read that blog. Yeah.
And then it was like, I don't know, for some reason we were like, oh, we don't want to be stressed about producing next week's episode. So we didn't launch it until we'd already recorded 10 episodes. And so we knew that it was going to be reliable for at least 2 months. You know, that we would be able to get somewhat ahead of that. So it would be like 3 months. And we kind of knew that we wouldn't be out of shows. And that was a piece of it that in retrospect turned out to have been good, because I think that we were really surprised. We should dig out this text thread. But I remember that after that first day when we released the first 3 episodes, and we kind of used our Rolodex and, you know, knew a lot of people and sent emails, you should give this a listen or whatever. And in those first few days, a lot of people were listening, or at least it seemed like a lot to us. Like, we weren't really expecting a huge audience. It was mostly our little research project. And all of a sudden, I don't remember now, it probably would seem like really small numbers, but I remember then we were like, oh my God, 100 people downloaded, you know,
and
it started to feel like it was a real thing. And, you know, and that kind of started to build on itself. Like, I think that very early on, you know, we started to really try to grapple with, okay, this actually might just not be our little research project. This might be an actual operation. So that what's this really about? I will note one thing. We actually re-recorded our first episode after we had finished the whole first 10, because we felt like it wasn't right and it wasn't the right place to start. So actually that approach really turned out good, because I think our first episode was stronger than it would have been had we just recorded a first episode and released it.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever go back and listen to my first episode. I'll keep that on the archive.
I don't recommend it.
No.
Past versions of ourselves are lame.
I know, right?
I'm wrong about everything 3 years ago, Lex.
Well, we just got an email from somebody who was kind of starting to listen to the podcast and had some, you know, constructive
some feedback for you.
And I was like, this is like being in a time machine, you know, like, I don't believe those things anymore.
Right. And you're not going to go back and change it. I mean, anything on the internet, you put it out there and then it's done. So let's think about those, you know, kind of really get into the nitty gritty of this, those last 3 years. You know, if somebody is a diehard fan and they have listened to every single one of your episodes, what's the goal here? Like, what are you hoping that person now thinks, does, how have they changed? Like, what would the canon that you've produced, the people that you've talked to, the conversations that you've had, someone who's absorbed all of that content, how might they be different now than when, you know, before they heard those conversations?
Yeah. So on the one, I'm like finding myself asking myself, do I hope they're different? I do hope they're different. But mostly I think that I hope they're the same on some level. I hope that I don't know all of our listeners and why they're listening. Like, to me, I hope that one of the services we can provide is that people's instincts, the instinct that, you know, Judaism can be more than this. Like, the instinct that, like, what I see in my local community, like, sure, maybe it's not, by the way. Maybe there's places where we really don't have, on a basic level, the kinds of Jewish life that are meeting people's needs. But like, let's say, even if it is like, okay, my hope is that we can be a voice from like a, whether we're a Jewish institution is like a complicated, like, I guess we're like a Jewish institutional voice. We're also analyzing a Jewish, like, we're also like playing this role of analyzing the Jewish institutional apparatus. But like, my hope is that we can actually be a voice affirming people who think, you know what, this isn't quite right in certain ways. I think so often there's this defense mechanism from folks who work in Jewish life to say, oh, no, you don't know about this organization, which is exactly what you want, that you're telling me you need this and like this institution would meet it. Or, oh, you just didn't know that we offer this program. Like, that's actually the thing that will make you feel better about this space. You'll feel more welcome.
Oh, like, program. Right? That's the answer to everything. It's just program.
I hope that I think we've gotten notes to this effect where I hope that, you know, us as people that are kind of deeply in it, like thinking about all these Jewish communal questions, et cetera, and still say to people, yeah, this isn't quite this isn't quite what we'd like it to be. My hope is that we can be that affirmational, that's not a word, but I'm making it up. We can be an affirmational voice for people. And I would like people to be different on some level. I like if people who are in roles working in Jewish life listen to us, my hope is that many of those people, by the way, we've learned this and it's surprised us, like many of those people agree with us very strongly, even as we are criticizing systems and structures in Jewish life. Often what it is that they agree, but they can't always make the changes they would like because of how institutions are structured. If they were resistant to some of our ideas, my hope is that they've heard from enough different voices at this point that, like, you know what? Yeah, we do have an issue with how Jews of color are treated in Jewish life.
Right.
Yeah,
or if they see that door cracked open a little bit, then they're willing to push it open and say, yeah, you know, I heard this one person talk about this one thing that I might be able to, you know, make those more incremental changes.
Yeah. And then the last piece that I hope, like, to me, this is sort of the thesis statement that I say to people. I don't know if this would be Dan's, but like my thesis statement of our podcast basically at this point is Judaism is yours. It's not like you, I'm not going to say own. It's not like I don't want it to be a property thing, but like Judaism is yours, each person's, and it is ours. Like we define what it is. We say like there's all these conversations about what's truly Jewish X. If you change something in this way, will it still be Jewish? If these people are allowed to do this thing, will that alter the product of Judaism so that it's no longer Judaism? Like it's ours.
Right.
What we do and what we do as Jews and often as people adjacent to Jews in Jewish families or Jewish friends of Jews, what we all do is the thing. That's Judaism. Or as I'm thinking more and more now, that's plural Judaisms in our world that is becoming more and more a set of micro communities more than like one uniform big Jewish community.
Right. As opposed to people who say this is Judaism and this is not Judaism.
Right.
Right. Where that line really is or is blurred. Dan, what do you think? How have you changed that one person listen to all 100 and whatever programs?
Yeah. It's fascinating to hear Lex describe it that way because I'm thinking about how I told my own story that until I read Who Wrote the Bible, right, I didn't really know there was an alternative to the kind of Judaism that I'd been presented with. And that was a time, when now we're talking about the late 80s, there was no internet. There was, you know, very little. It's funny. It's not, I think about why the ultra-Orthodox communities sometimes don't want people to have exposure to the internet. And I can kind of see why, because it's dangerous for the institutions, for people to find out that there are alternatives. Now, I think that it's also dangerous, especially in a time of choice, for people to not find out that there are alternatives. That's dangerous for the whole project. So because they might just leave not only the institution, but all of Jewish life, which probably I would have done. And so you could argue that my reading Who Wrote the Bible was a threat to the Orthodox institutions that I had been part of at that time, but it was a boon to Judaism as a whole because it's what kept me in. So I think that, like, I agree with Lex that one of the things that I hope we're offering is for people to know that if I don't really like the Judaism that I've experienced up till now, that there's hope that it could be different. And I think that where I would take it one step further, you know, how I hope that we have changed people, although I think that our next challenge is to offer people an opportunity to do something next. But I think that I want somebody to be listening and to say, what can I do to advance this idea of alternative forms of Judaism so that other people who are not listening to the podcast or, you know, might be able to meet them and to have a more positive experience than I've been having. And there are some people who are doing that naturally. I think that we need to try to create more context for people to be able to do it. I would just add one thing that I have a much more radical take, I think, on what I hope that people will do, although I don't expect that most or even, you know, I don't expect that all or most or even a substantial percentage of our listeners will agree with me or have to. But, you know, my radical take on it is back to this idea that we're in this profound change in the history of Judaism and that that all of the institutions that we have today are not going to survive on the other end of it. Right. And you know, that could be a bitter pill to swallow, especially for Jewish professionals. You know, my friend B'nai Lappi, who talks about this, she talks about option one, which is sort of trying to shore up the existing institutions and forms, and then what she calls option three, which is creating new forms. And she says, you know, if you're drawing your paycheck from option one, you're not going to be an option three person. Now, that, like Lex said, we have discovered is not true.
Yeah.
In the sense that we expected, I expected a lot more pushback from Jewish professionals, from rabbis and other Jewish professionals, to the ideas that we're putting out in the podcast, especially the more radical ideas that rabbinic Judaism is, you know, in its ending days, et cetera. And what I tend to hear from people is you're totally right. We totally agree with that. You know, and then I'm like, well, then why are you working? You know, and, you know, I've heard all kinds of interesting responses, yeah. You know, my pension. and that's fine. That's totally understandable. But what's been interesting is how much the ideas that we're putting out there and amplifying from others, people like Yitz Greenberg, are actually quite well accepted. And so then the question is, okay, well, if you do have the same radical view as we do, or I do, about where we are in Jewish history, it's like, what do you want your legacy to be? Like, do you want your legacy to be that you are, you know, as we say, you know, often, right, the Dvar Torah is often given about Nachshon, who is the person who jumped into the Red Sea before it parted, when it seemed really dangerous, right? And only after that faith was shown did the waters of the Red Sea part. So what would it look like to be those Nachshons today? And that can be a cliche, but I'm serious. Like, what does it look like to jump in? Because we've done it. You know, what does it look like to jump in to a place where you're not going to be paid very well and you're not going to have a pension?
Oh, you're right? So pushy, Dan. So much Jewish guilt. Talking about legacies.
But it's interesting because the Jewish guilt leads in the other direction, right? Usually the Jewish guilt is, so therefore you should work to shore up our institutions. And,
right.
And I'm happily applying some Jewish guilt to say, you know, right, that Jewish guilt maybe bends in the opposite direction, that right. What would it look like if we had sort of a massive turn of the energies and creativity of those who are in the Jewish professional world towards a more radical approach to Jewish life? But there's real danger in that in terms of personal comfort.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, just to put a fine point on it, because I think sometimes I worry that the reason we don't get more pushback is because people hear us as like less radical than we're trying to be.
Oh, those like, cute kids over there, their podcast.
Like sometimes I worry about that. So I want to say like directly some, like a few things. For us, my favorite conversations that we have, I've got a lot of it. One of my favorite categories of conversations that we have is when we're looking at a holiday. So Hanukkah or Shavuot. Or the Shavuot was a big one for us, but pick your holiday. And we ask the following, like, what has this holiday been? What can it be? And that's like a simple question on one level. But for us, it's very much not trivial. And what we're saying with that is, okay, so Hanukkah may have been about light. I mean, like, I do think Hanukkah will probably remain about light. And you know, having a holiday of light in the winter, and about Maccabees, and about like I think that for a little while, many of the parts of Hanukkah that we take for granted, the story of it, the rituals of it, will remain the same. But like, I'm really excited to ask the question: like, if we saw a transformation of Hanukkah as big as the transformation from, like, we had plenty of years where there was no idea of an oil miracle. We had a few hundred years between the narrative of the books of Maccabees, which, you know, they're not in the canon, but that's the story that's being discussed. We had many hundreds of years between then and the Talmud, which enshrined this idea of the miracle of the oil. So for as many hundreds of years as would take us back to like Columbus, we had no oil miracle. So like, what, like, if we were to have something as new to Hanukkah that we create now, that nobody has heard of, and that, by the way, automatically will be deemed not Jewish at the beginning, because it's not, it would be new, it would be separate. Right. What would that mean? And like with Shavuot, it's even more drastic, because Shavuot on a basic level has changed multiple times. Like, what the thing is has changed. There's nothing in the text of the Torah about Shavuot being a holiday about Torah learning. about receiving the Ten Commandments. There's not even agreement in those texts that when the date of it is. But it was a pilgrimage festival. Nobody does pilgrimages on Shavuot now, as far as I know. Right. It was an agricultural moment, which I don't think it is for most people now. And then on a basic level, that stopped working. That wasn't what people needed to do anymore. And so they made it up. They made up that this day was going to be a moment to celebrate, in particular, the Ten Commandments, but also the Torah. And let's throw Ruth in there. Ruth is a great book, and we haven't had a day of the calendar where we're going to celebrate. So let's throw Ruth in it. My mom's name is Ruth. I love the book.
There you go. Well, you're looking at the essence of why it is that we're doing this, and then taking that essence and saying, how else can we do this that's more meaningful to us? I have a one-year-old, and this is our first time doing Halloween. And the whole time I was like, ugh, what is this? Why are we doing this? Why am I buying all this candy and having strangers come to my door? How can I elevate this tradition that I don't really connect to? So it's very interesting to hear from both of you the desire for people to take the information and do something, right? Whereas I think because you're the host and your perspective is those conversations that you're having with these people, what I would kind of assume more often than not is that you are people's Judaism, right? So you have people who maybe don't belong to a shul, don't really celebrate. Maybe they are single. Maybe they are married but don't have kids. Maybe they have lots of kids and no time, right? And so they turn to the information they're given them because, unlike my program that's very specific to working in the Jewish world, right? You're so broad. So yeah, sometimes you're talking about holidays, sometimes you're talking about books being released or Jewish linguistics, or it's so broad that I can't say that it's very unlikely that there are people that are, you are the unboundness, right? You are the untraditional Judaism that people have as part of their life to listen to these conversations and think to themselves a little more deeply about whatever it is, the topic that you guys are talking about. So as opposed to then not doing anything, right? And then just feeling more Jewish, right? Isn't that to me, I'm the executive director for a synagogue. And I'm like, that is goal number one, right? How do we help people feel more connected and just to Judaism, to each other, to these values that I think everyone who practices Judaism in some way feels like they make them a better person. And by kind of listening to the conversations you guys are having, helps them kind of think about that, helps them think about their own lives and how they can bring meaning to it. So I love that both of you guys are like, everyone who listens is going to go change the Jewish world into their image of what they want. And I argue the opposite of, the service that you're giving to people who might otherwise not feel connected or literate, right, Lex, feeling like you're left out. And now, someone who's listening to your program is like, oh yeah, I was listening to, a conversation with some guys in New York who's doing this cool art project, something that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to tap into that you have made very accessible for people to tap into, which I think is the exact example of what you're trying to take and kind of inject, right? Trying to inject into the bricks and mortar of what was built 100 years ago. And so I just wanted to kind of put my perspective on your program in there and go a little bit further with you. Because Dan, you were talking about, we're in this point where we're wandering Jews, right? We have these institutions. They may or may not be working for people. They may or may not be dying. But I can kind of see the perspective of when those institutions were created, right? There was a huge catalyst of change. There was physical movement. We've had times in the past where many, many, many times in the past, actually, where we've been forced into change, right? We've been forced into a new place. We've been forced into a new circumstance. We've been had our institution completely destroyed in front of us, right? And those changes, not easy, but that was the catalyst for this change, right? Whereas we're sitting somewhere in a space that there is no catalyst, at least not yet. Thank God there, hopefully there won't ever be, especially in the American Jewish community, that is pushing us in that direction. So it's the people, it's the ground, it's those that are connecting that are saying, I don't know if this is, the direction I want to go in. And we're seeing this change without that catalyst. So I'd love to just hear a little more in terms of perspective on that, in terms of what Jewish communal organizations are doing wrong, what they could be doing better, specifically for those in the field, you know, collecting those paychecks, but looking for those cracks in the door to say, hey, why don't we try this new thing that I heard about? Or, you know, I was talking to some of the participants or donors or whoever you have in your community, and, you know, they really didn't like this thing, but they're really looking for just a time to go hang out with each other, right? Or what does that kind of look like? So I want to dive a little bit more in for our listeners into sort of the institutionalness of what we're doing and the uninstitutionalness of what you guys have created. So go.
Yeah.
Either one of you.
Well, it's really interesting what you say about, you know, just as a starting point, it's really interesting what you say about people for whom our podcast is their Judaism. We intentionally release our new episodes on Fridays specifically so that people who don't otherwise have a Shabbat practice, or whose Shabbat practice isn't to go to synagogue or whatever, could have an alternative that's still a deep Jewish experience that is a different kind of Jewish experience. And we've heard from people right. that are using it that way, and we're thrilled. Now, not everybody's using it that way, and they don't have to. One of the things that's interesting in just putting something out into the world, particularly on the internet, where we don't control it in almost any way. I mean, we don't use channels that we have any control over to distribute it. It's right. on, you know, iTunes and Amazon, you know, I can't say your name, but whatever that, you know, people can access. So it's interesting because there's also a divergence between what we are trying to do, what we want, what we're looking for ourselves, and the way that other people can use what we create in ways that are also beneficial. And right. I have no opposition to that. You know, what I'm trying to make sure is that I'm always pushing myself to remember why I'm doing this, right? And I'm doing this for that radical purpose. I'm looking right. to like, lead people
happy,
into the wilderness.
Conclusion, yeah.
Yeah. You know, my dad, who's you know, a rabbi and a very affiliated Jew, will often listen to a podcast and say, you know, either he liked it or he didn't like it, or he makes recommendations. You know, and I say, Dad, you know, you're not really the audience for this podcast. You know, I appreciate that you listen,
right.
but the main reason why you listen is because your son is the host, which I appreciate very much. But the main reason, like a lot of other people, are listening because they find these conversations interesting. Mm-hmm. But I'm really creating it for the people who want to go out and do something more radical.
Right.
You know, right now that said, I think that it does go back to the theory of disruptive innovation, which is where we started the podcast, which I think is really important to understand in two dimensions. One is that the theory of disruptive innovation is there to explain why game-changing, paradigm-shifting innovations tend not to come from existing larger institutions. And the right. main reason is because the happy customers of those institutions don't give the leadership enough leeway, enough room, enough resources to really go out there and investigate the new opportunity in a really serious and sustained and substantial way. They might throw a little bit of resources in that direction, but it tends to be not enough to really make that opportunity available in a big way. And there's a lot of nuance to it, but that's the basic idea. And on the flip side, number two, is that the new ideas that do end up being paradigm shifting are very thin and small when they first come onto the scene. And they tend to be looked down on by the people who are happy customers of the existing institution. They say, look, how does that hold together? You know, your podcast is somebody's Judaism? That's ridiculous, right? And I think it's ridiculous.
Right.
You know, meaning that
no, like, it's amazing. That's the point.
No, but I think it's ridiculous in the sense that, like, do I aspire to a world, you know, 100 years from now where people's Judaism is to listen to a podcast? No. The question is whether right. listening to a podcast as your primary connection to Judaism is something that over the next 100 years can be layered on and layered on and layered on so that it becomes extremely rich and nuanced and ultimately a really great way to be Jewish. And I think it's so easy to imagine that the priests of the Second Temple would have looked at these early forms of rabbinic Judaism with that same level of disdain. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you have no sacrifices? Like, what kind of
right.
a Judaism is that?
Right.
And so I think that while it's wonderful to me, the idea that people who are working in existing Jewish organizations might listen to some of what we're saying and say, hey, that really gives me a great new idea for how we can connect better with certain people that are not connecting to our institution. And hey, I work with synagogues to help them become more innovative and more more successful in the short term at trying to do some of those things. And I think it's wonderful and I think it's important. But at the same time, like what's really driving me is the idea that that in another area of the completely uninstitutionalized, right, the people, what the theory of disruptive innovation calls non-consumption, the people that are not doing any of this right now,
right,
that's where the new Judaism is going to ultimately come from. And it's going to take all kinds of ideas from the old Judaism and move them over to the new area. But that's kind of, what really excites me is the idea that people from the institutions would go out into the world of non-consumption and say, no, our goal isn't to try to draw those people to our institutions. Our goal is to create new institutions, right, that are responsive to those folks.
I'm gonna let Lex respond as well, but I want to just throw out, like, you had a conversation with David Brightman. I think it was a two-part conversation. Talked to him as well. I loved that he turned an institution into something better. And I mm-hmm. have to have hope that that is possible. And unfortunately, it's heavy on the shoulders of the people in the C-suite, which is unfortunate for those at the bottom that listen to your program and want to implement these changes. But I do have this hope inside that these institutions don't have to die to be reborn in a way that meets the needs that we're referring to.
But I guess what I would ask you is, like, why is that bad? Like, why is it bad for an institution to die? Like, people die. You know, it's natural. It's the way that life works, is that people die and they have babies and the babies grow up and they're different, right? That's the way that progress happens in life. And I just wonder why we're resistant to that institutionally.
Just because there are building blocks, right? So there's something my grandmother did, whether she's dead or not, that has allowed me to sit in this chair in this position right now, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something there in terms of, I mean, as someone who has ever tried to start their own nonprofit, in terms of even just the structure, right? The building, the computers, the budget, the bank accounts, like so much scaffolding that had been created that could support more easily. You know, we're sitting here talking on a podcast that for me is only possible because of the Jim Joseph Foundation, like this already scaffolding thing. And when I talked to David from Moshe House, he's like, there's no way Moshe House would have been possible without the support of the federations and support of the institutions in getting to where we are. But at the same time, at that one point, are you either, you know, assimilated into that or weighed down by that? Or, you know, there's obviously quid pro quo, yeah. You know, sorry to use that term.
call it bribery.
Call it what it is. There's this dichotomy we have in our community right now. So it's not so sad that something will die. Of course, things will die. It's the question of, can the good in that, you know, be transferred, be lifted, be reimagined into the new?
Here's my issue. I mean, so you hinted at something that I think about a lot, which is like what my grandparents did and like maintaining that. And I spend a lot of time trying in myself to calibrate what my grandparents, who I actually met, like they were, I mean, I didn't know them for real, but like they
were
concrete,
yeah,
tangible to me. I try to balance that with my grandchildren who do not exist. I don't have children yet. And I think we are terrible as human beings at doing that. And I don't blame anyone, but like it's in the grand scheme of time, when we're long gone, we will be as close generationally to our grandparents as our grandchildren. So if we spend our days agonizing over the things that we would lose that will upset our grandparents, like it might be that we need specifically, in order to meet the needs of our grandchildren, for those things to either vigorously change or have something else pop up. So like, I'm not comfortable. I mean, there's all these organizations, I'm not going to name names, but there are organizations that were really big players in the mid 20th century that continue to like theoretically exist, mm-hmm, with like they only have, you know, a few people involved. They might not even have full-time staff anymore, but like they exist and they like people continue to give money to them because to lose them would be this catastrophe, because it would be a symbol right. of like the end of an era. And it's like, I think I do have to name a name now, and I'm going to choose one because of recent news. Like, my grandchildren are not going to care about the American Jewish Congress. Right. I'm very confident about that. They might care about it historically. I'd actually like them to care about it historically. I think there's a lot of really important pieces when we look at the American Jewish Congress historically. The American Jewish Congress right now, I actually went and looked because they recently had like a public kerfluffle around, but like they have no people involved. They're like not a real institution, and we continue, and a few folks continue to donate to them. That's not what we should be doing. We should be thinking about how we prioritize both preservation, both the things that we have inherited from the past that we do want to preserve and that are really important, and the pieces that that don't exist yet, but to our grandchildren are going to be authentic. I think back to summer camp all the time, where ask the 10-year-old what a camp, like how long a camp tradition has been around.
Right.
If it was created 3 years ago. Ask that 10-year-old, right. and they'll say, forever. It's always been that way. It's always been that way. And look, there's a million things about Jewish life that we don't always explicitly say this, but we feel like they've always been that way.
Right.
Synagogue structures in the way that we have them in America. First off, they've never been like this anywhere in the world. In the way that we have denominational movements set up, in the way that we have edifices, in the way that we have Sunday school wings, in the way that we have
or even how they're just like programs and community centers. Like it was just a house of worship, right?
That's very, very new. So the idea that losing a particular synagogue, or even losing the entire model of synagogues, which I don't either advocate for or against, but I think is a possibility.
Right.
Like the idea that that would be a grand catastrophe in Jewish history because it would symbolize the end of like Judaism. I think people feel that way, but I don't think it holds up to scrutiny. Like we pretend that things age back to Sinai. I was saying Mi-Sinai. I was merging to Sinai and Mi-Sinai. We should embrace that. We should recognize that at every point in our Jewish journey, that's really been multiple Jewish journeys, but for lack of a better term, like in every step of that story, we've wildly changed what Judaism is from decade to decade, from century to century. So like, let's keep doing that. Let's not try to resist that. Let's make the theological, the sociological, the institutional, let's make every one of those changes just as our ancestors did before us.
Right. So here's where I'm, and I'll take your example of American Jewish Congress, right? So we have this organization been around for whatever. They have pictures of them, of people when they're really old and their name is somewhere in that picture. you know, that's the value you see, right? Oh my gosh, you did something in 1920. But you know, and even looking at their website, it's not relevant to anybody. But the question is, if there was some amazing CEO that came in and said, I'm going to turn you around, we're going to rebrand, we're now, whatever's a really awesome name for Jews. I mean, Ben the Ark is a great name, but like some other new exciting name, they've shifted their focus. They've talked to people in terms of what is the essentials here, right? What are we trying to do? What did our ancestors try to do with this, creating this organization, right? Be a Jewish voice in politics, right? Now, they're not the only people in the game, right, to do this. There's other organizations that are doing it, clearly doing a lot better than they were able to change and adapt into. But to say that this has to shut and new doors have to open in a completely new model without the history, without the weight, right, of, what American Jewish Congress has been, and instead being able to say, we're going to take this and reshape it and reform it and modernize it, and the essential DNA of Jews should be involved in American politics can be there. Or are you saying, doesn't matter?
I don't actively like set out to destroy organizations. I want to make that clear. Like I don't, like in the grand scheme, I'm pretty agnostic about the existence,
whether they exist or not, right?
Like if they totally transform in a way that they're basically something new, and they retroject that we're, they play, I mean, this is what we do Jewishly, by the way. Like we do something entirely new and then we play a game of make-believe. I'm like pulling back the curtain now, but like we pretend that it's always been that way.
Right.
Find your, Google your nearest sermon about how Jewish meditation and Jewish yoga dates back for millennia. I'm telling you, nobody knew what Jewish yoga was more than the last few decades. And I love that people look, there are elements of the Jewish past that we can look at that are embodied forms of Judaism that resemble things that people are now practicing as Jewish yoga. There are practices that can absolutely be looked at as precursors to kinds of Jewish meditation we have now. But we have new things that are providing rich meaning in people's lives. And they didn't come up because people were like, they came up because some other groups outside of the Jewish people were doing them. And then we found a way. And by the way, there's issues of appropriation that come up here that we could talk about for another 7 hours.
Right.
But they came from elsewhere. And then we found a way to, in a new way, not in an old way, do those things Jewishly. And like, let's embrace that. And I, on the one hand, I love the practice of, you know, yes, we can find in, you know, the practice of Heat Bodedut from Rabbi Nachman, like a precedent for Jewish meditation today. Like, that's true.
Right.
It's not, but like, we should recognize that we're doing a retrojection. We are, we're doing that in order to create an enshrined status for something that really is new. And the rabbis did that. The rabbis said that a bunch of things that they were doing dated back for longer than they really did. They said Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob kept all of the meat and dairy separation laws, even though we have a sentence in Genesis that says Abraham served meat with milk. Like, that's, on the one hand, I think it's silly. On the other, I get it. Like, I get why we do that, but we should consciously do it. We should make the new things, know that they're new. And then to the extent we need to anchor it on other material, we should do that. We should always have a vast archive and never lose records of the past, especially in a world where we can do so digitally really easily. But we should use that to propel us in new exciting directions, not as an anchor that weighs us down, not permitting our ship to like leave the shipyard.
So as a Jewish professional, in a synagogue as executive director, trying to do things like help them launch a podcast and a new website and an app and, you know, make religious school a little more relevant and do these things that make this a thriving community that is modern and relevant and all that good stuff. That's your audience, right? That's some of the people that you're talking to and some people who listen to your program and say, that sounds great, but back to doing the thing that nobody really wants me wants at all, but I'm going to do it because it's my paycheck. What's the advice? What's the, for people, you know, who are still working at AJC or, you know, the myriad of other organizations that might see their organization either floundering or succeeding. I mean, there's no, you know, one template for what is happening in the community. But you know, you're going to work every day and or you're not and you're sitting at home creating a new project, right? There's lots of different professionals out there. What's some advice that we can give them?
I mean, I would say that the first question that I would ask such a person is, do you agree with what I'm saying about where we are in Jewish history or not? If you do, then I would say find a way to get out of that job in the long term, because that, I'm not saying quit your job tomorrow. I'm saying start thinking about a way to transition, talk to us, talk to other people, to transition into a job that is in the world of the new. Now, because while I agree with everything that you said earlier about, you know, I used to think the way that you were articulating earlier about like the waste of all the resources that existing institutions have and how, what a waste if they just are lost and the new stuff comes out of this, you know, scrappy, non-funded, you know, kind of area out in the world of non-consumption. And I agree that it is a waste, but I've come to believe that that's how change happens when we're in periods of major change. And it's a shame, you know, in a certain way, but that's how it happens. And there's all sorts of theory about it, and that's where the energy is. And You know, that's how it is. And yet, can it happen sometimes in existing institutions? Yes, very, very rarely. And you have to understand that the theory, all the theory is against you, you know, and right. So it can happen. But I would say for the most part, a person should say, if I believe that we're actually at this transition where we're on the cusp of a new form of Judaism, then you're right, we can't take our institutions with us into the wilderness. That's why we needed a mishkan. That's why we need a mobile institution. You can't take the temple into the wilderness. And so so what I would say is, like, try to start thinking about making that transition. Now, if you don't agree with my analysis of where we are in Jewish history, and nobody needs to, because I think so many of our podcast guests are still interesting, they don't agree with what I'm saying. You know, right. there's a lot that you can appreciate even about the things that we're doing, even if you don't accept that view of where we are in Jewish history, then I would say that the question becomes, so think hard about what is the challenge that's facing us. You know, is it a marketing challenge? Do we have a problem with the product, that, so to speak, that we're selling or that we're creating? Where is the challenge? You know, and I think that I think that at the very least, right, I would say, hey, maybe we can salvage rabbinic Judaism, right? Maybe there are elements of the way that the Judaism that we've had for the last 2,000 or so years, maybe it still could work in a certain way. But think hard about how it could work. You know, and basically what that comes down to is another theory that comes from Clayton Christensen, that is what he calls the jobs to be done theory. He says, imagine you're a, quote, customer, in our case, the potential participant, the potential affiliated Jew. Imagine that person as a corporation that has a job opening. You know, there's a job opening in their life. They have a need. What is that need that nobody else is fulfilling? Is that a need for mindfulness? Is that a need to know how to be a better parent? Is that a need to know how to juggle my crazy life? You know, there are deep needs that people are not getting met anywhere in the world. Our competition is not another religion. Our competition is the absence of anybody helping these folks. And then there's a question, like any job description that's open when I'm applying for a job is like, do I have the skills to do that job? I mean, I don't, there are lots of open jobs that I never applied for because, you know, they were for like somebody who has a math degree. Alex could do that, but I can't, you know.
So
the question then becomes like, gee, does Judaism really have the tools to help people with those things that they need in their lives? And I think that in many cases, the answer is it has the raw material, but the way that Judaism has been organized and presented up until now is such that it doesn't, if you really are honest about it, it doesn't really have ways of helping prosperous people, right, living high on Maslow's hierarchy of needs in the West with total freedom, you know, all of the ways that you might describe the majority of American Jews, Judaism doesn't really have the toolbox already deployed as to how to help them. So I think that if you're inside of a Jewish institution, I think the question becomes, how can I be a force within my institution for making sure that our institution is focused on the needs of the human beings that we seek to serve? And understanding that that's going to mean that we have to do more than marketing, that we're going to have to do some substantial reworking of Judaism in order to sort of shape it so that it really fulfills those needs. And what's that going to look like in our institution? And can I be the driver to try to get our institution to refocus in that way?
Dan, you're exhausting me. You got a lot of work ahead of you.
Yeah.
We'll check in the next 10 years of your podcast. I'm going to get to you, Lexi. I do want to hear yours as well. But I had one other quick question I was thinking about. You know, you talk about, you know, leave your job, mass exodus, let's do it. You know, it makes me think about things like the institutions that are trying to support that, right? So all I can really think of at the top of my head is Upstart and their, you know, incubators. And I think ROI is in the same way in terms of like, give us your poor and your struggling and your, you know, innovative artists that have an idea or have tried to start an idea and let's do it, right? Let's support you in doing that. Is that enough? Would I have the support, the scaffold around like helping me figure out funders and connect me with donors and what do I need for a business model and what is that going to look like? How do I do that? Like, how do I walk away from, as you said, the pension and the paycheck? And then what if my idea isn't so great?
Well, let me say two quick things, and then Lex.
I'm sorry, Lex.
No, just two quick things. One is that the answer, and Lex is saying it too, the answer is no. I hope that the funding world will over time start to make opportunities available for folks who are doing that. And here we have to talk about a much more adventurous form of funding that imagines that most of the funds are going to be lost for exactly that reason, that most of the ideas are not going to be good. But I think of it as like
investment capital. Anyone want 5% in my podcast?
Right, well, I think of it as like pharmaceutical research where most of the experiments fail. And that's how that kind of research works. But number two is that what I would also say to the people, and I think this is also a bitter pill, is that maybe this is not a time in Jewish history when those of us who want to have our legacy be that we were among the sort of early imaginers of the future of Judaism, maybe this isn't a time in Jewish history where we can make a good living doing that, right? And maybe we have to get other jobs. You know, maybe we have to earn our living, right? And when you look at the early rabbis, there's a very important and amazing story in the Talmud about Rabbi Joshua, who was one of the most important of the early rabbis, and another rabbi, Rabban Gamliel, who is making his living doing Judaism, or at least he comes from a very wealthy family, and he goes to visit Rabbi Joshua, and he sees that he's actually a charcoal maker. And he kind of says, like, why are you a charcoal maker?
Right.
Rabbi, why are you a charcoal maker? And he sort of says, like, what kind of a leader are you that you don't realize that your faculty has to make a living doing another job? And maybe that's just the way it is in times like this. And it sucks if you love Judaism so much that you want to make your career in it. Maybe you can get a job in the old organizations, you know. But in the evenings, you know, you do your podcast or whatever.
Yeah.
Until
that's something that becomes sustainable enough that is then supporting.
Which of course will happen to all of us. Yeah.
So Dan and I have the same instinct on this, which is, look, like, I'll say it flatly, like, Dan and I make less money than we would like to.
Right.
Like, I know that other Jewish nonprofit professionals like also feel that way, but like, I can't create a false sense of security that like leaving the institutional infrastructure is going to flower and immediately create that security. Like, I think we have really big questions to ask generally about in Jewish communities, how we relate to class and what we think the threshold is for, like, what level of comfort we feel is necessary versus desirable. And I think that how we've crafted Jewish communities in many ways centers people of upper middle and upper class and marginalizes people who aren't. And so I think that these questions are very real. And there's a whole set of people who never are able to access the institutions in the first place as they exist due to some of the class restrictions. I talk to people my own age all the time who would be in rabbinical school right now if they could afford it.
Right.
They would be there. Like, that's the only thing that's standing in their way. But as a general thing, not only do I say it as like a bummer that I think we need to deprofessionalize, I think we need to have more people for whom Judaism is either, like Dan said, not their full-time job, or it's like the radical parts that they're doing. Yeah, they're doing the podcast on nights and weekends, whatever it is. I also am excited about that. Like, I think magical things happen when Judaism is the fun thing you do on the side as opposed to your job. Like, I actually think it's really good when people who are doing something else do something Jewish, because they're so like, I feel this way about myself sometimes, even as I love my job, but like, it's a job. So you do it enough time and certain things get routine. And it's like, if you pulled me aside and said, like, how would you feel about talking about a Jewish thing and having a few thousand people listen to it? I'd say, that's awesome. Holy crap. That is amazing. I can tell you, as I'm editing the podcast every day and filtering out people's ums every 15 to 20 seconds and doing noise reductions.
Oh,
and like,
man.
You speak my language, man. Right. It's not the most, I don't feel
glamorous,
that all
right?
the time.
Yeah.
But when somebody... And this is, on the one hand, people think about lay leaders in this situation. And I want to be clear. I'm talking sort of about lay leaders, but I'm also not. Like, I'm talking about people who just, they have some passion and like, they really like X holiday. And so I think of my mom. Like, my mom has never been a Jewish communal professional. She's, She's not somebody who could like list you facts about Bible or like anything, but she is like, her Passover Seder to me is incredible. And I credit it with so much of who I am. Like before anybody was making their own Haggadot, maybe not anybody, before it was a thing that there was a Haggadot.com, like the first year it was up, we made our own. And before that, we already sort of had our own and we were using different Haggadahs. We had a screen up with showing YouTube videos when YouTube was like a year or two old.
That's awesome.
We had like, there's been frogs on my table since I was 1 year old. There's been all of the, like, and we've been playing, making up games for Passover. Like she for Passover has a passion for it. And she's a lawyer and works long hours and commutes 45 minutes there and 45 minutes back from Milwaukee to Racine every day. And she finds a lot of hours, and that's before the cooking, to create a really amazing Passover experience that I think people actually go to and are like, wow, that was awesome. Not, that was nice. We preserved a tradition that has been going on for a long time, and I'm glad that we did that. And like, I want to be a part. Like, no, that was actually like serious fun. That was,
I hope my
so
husband
great.
Isn't listening because I'm really sick of the Haggadah that we use for two nights every year for the last however long we've been married. I'm ready to take over Passover, right? I'm done with it. But
like we like the instinct people have is like whoever the folks are that are most talented, and I hear this conversation in recruitment for Jewish jobs, it's like, oh, we gotta find like the people who are doing X, Y, or Z great thing in some other realm of the world. We should get them to be Jewish professionals. And it's like I mean, on the one hand, yes, I would like more people with fascinating different kinds of backgrounds to work professionally in Jewish life. But like, I'd also want those same people to do their thing external to the institutions. The institutions don't get any credit. They don't need any credit.
Right.
They build a great, amazing Jewish project. And then we are along for the ride. I think of, honestly, like the things that are doing the most Jewish work in the world right now might be TV shows like Transparent or Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or Broad City, that those people aren't doing it like because they want to do a Jewish project, but like there's a heavy dose of Jewish stuff in those shows that ends up having a tangible impact on on thousands and thousands, and in some cases maybe even millions of Jews. So like I want those people to not feel like all of the Jewish change work happens in this one sphere. Like it's going to happen in other spheres because Jews are in it in pretty much all of those spheres. And we should be thrilled about that because we need Jewish leaders both to reference a concept Dan and I have used a lot. Like we need Jewish leaders who have a ton of knowledge, who have like deep familiarity with Jewish traditions, texts, etc., who can mobilize those in new, exciting ways. And we need people specifically who don't have that knowledge, specifically people who they don't know what Rosh Hashanah is supposed to be, quote unquote. So they do the thing that they want to do to mark a Jewish New Year. They don't know which readings you're supposed to do for Tashlich, for throwing your sins in the, so like they come up with whatever cool things they want to do instead, or they remake Tashlich entirely. There's very cool like Tashlichs that people do in Sunday schools, separate from Rivers. And it's like, to me, it's like, let's be excited about that. Let's not play this game where we need to throw out the fishing line and reel everybody into the Jewish institutional world. Like, let's say we're all over the place and we're all able to make those contributions, whether or not we have a master's degree in Jewish X.
Nonprofit management.
Yeah. Awesome, studies, guys. Education.
No, that's just what I have. So thank you guys both so much for your time, Dan and Lex, Lex and Dan. Before we wrap up, I just want to give you an opportunity if there's anything that we've touched upon that you wanted to revisit or thoughts that you had in your brain. I know this is what you do day in and day out. And so it's something you think about a lot. It's something I'm always thinking about both professionally and with this podcast. So is there anything else that either of you guys wanted to add your voice to before we wrap up?
I think this is good.
Good. Well, you guys keep trying to change it from the outside and I'll keep trying to change it from the inside. Yeah, right, and we'll have to meet up again somewhere in the middle.
Outside, so. Inside out, live in La Vida Loca.
Right. Thank you guys so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Like this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com. or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.